that's at the beginning of the class, everybody will want to know. Yeah, no, ask at the beginning of the class, and I'll answer. About what?
I just become ComStock's first year representative, so I'd like to introduce myself and. Yeah?
Sure. Well, wait till three. Go ahead. We will begin with an announcement.
I am the new first year representative for ComStock. And for those of you that are already members of ComStock, please read the newsletters because you missed out on a fun night And that's about it. If you want something from Comsoc, just come and see me, a suggestion maybe. And now I'll leave it to you.
Okay. Maybe do you want to tell everybody your name?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. My name is Catalina. You also know me as your Informatics One class representative, along with other people that I haven't really met yet. And your Mathematics for Informatics representative, along with someone else that if she wants to introduce herself.
That would be me. Another class rep. My name is Simona, and if you have any suggestions or problems, you can email me or Catalina.
Okay. So that's about it. And we would like to know about the class exam results.
Yeah, you can sit down and ask when I ask for questions.
Okay.
Yes. So this applause is seriously deserved by all the class reps. We have class meetings every year with the class reps to get feedback on how things are going. They are always extremely useful. So. We on the staff, I think you also as students, owe the class reps a debt for serving as that conduit for communication. Of course, if you want to send something to me by email to me directly or anybody else involved in the class, you're welcome to do so. But the class reps do a very good job of soliciting feedback and getting it to us. So thanks very much to all the class reps for what you do. Or who's here beside you that's a class rep for Inf1? Right, the two of you. So do we not have more class reps? There we go. Right, all class reps, stand up just for 1 minute. 1, 2, 3. And the other ones are being represented by not coming. Okay, but thanks all three. You are?
Thea.
Okay, are there any questions? I know of at least one. When and how will you get the results for the class test? So I'm just back from a trip, back this morning to 200 odd emails, which I've been plowing through. But I'm aware that there are 125 class exams sitting waiting to be marked. I'm hoping to be able to do it tomorrow afternoon. I don't know yet if the one of the TAs is going to be able to help me do it tomorrow afternoon. And I'm away on Wednesday. So I'm hoping they're going to be marked tomorrow afternoon and you'll get them back Thursday or Friday in your tutorials, but I can't quite promise that. But we are required to get them back to you within 2 weeks, and if I can't do that, I can't see any reason why you won't be able to pick them up here next Monday. So we will get them back to you within 2 weeks, as we're supposed to do, and I hope earlier than that. If I hadn't been away last week, I would have tried to get them back to you last week, but really hard to do when I'm not here. Yes? How was my trip? Very nice, thank you. I don't know if I mentioned this, but my daughter was playing chess for Scotland. She's the representative for Scotland under 12 girls. So we were at the World Youth Chess Championship, where there were people, you know, literally from all over the world playing chess. So, sorry?
Where did that take place?
That took place in Halkidiki in Greece. So it's my first time ever going off to a big event and not being, going there to speak at a conference or something and my family is accompanying me, but somebody in my family was going off to do something and I was accompanying them. It was my 11-year-old daughter, so that was wonderful. The entire Scottish team learned a great deal of chess. I don't think, they were all very good. Yes. I'm rotten at chess. And, I used to be able to beat my daughter, but now she always beats me. So that's what I was doing. That's why I wasn't here. I was watching my daughter play chess. Proud father. Okay, any other questions? Right, actually, I wanted to turn the question around and ask you, how was your week? How did you find the class exam? Okay. Sorry? hard without a compiler so that you can actually check. Yes, that's why we will do the final exam with a compiler. But I explained before why we can't do it that way. I'm sorry. I much prefer that you could do it online. And any other feedback? And how did you find the lecture that Phil Scott gave last week? Some nodding, some shaking. Okay, everybody nod or shake, and I can see. Okay. Very interesting. Okay. And again, you can always email me with comments or come see me later or whatever you like. Any other questions? I know it was a while back, but any questions about scope or? What are algebraic data types? Well, that's what we will cover today. That's always to have a nice question to have to. But so that's a good question about the new material. Any questions about the older material that we've had? Okay. So you've now learned how to write function definitions, right? You've learned about the list. You've learned about list comprehensions. You've learned about recursion and recursive definitions. So what's left? The only thing that's left that's a great new idea, the one last important bit, is algebraic data types. So what algebraic data types are about is we've seen how to do a recursive definition of lists, right? Right? A list is either the empty list, or it's a list, a constructed list built with cons, with a head and a tail, where the head is an element of the type of the list. If it's a list of integers, the head will be an integer. And the tail is itself a list of integers, and so on. So that's the list. And you know that natural numbers are very similar, right? A natural number is either 0, this is very similar to nil, or it's the successor of a natural number. So 3 is like the successor of the successor of the successor of 0. You can define any natural number that way. And you'll remember one of the lectures I ended up by showing you in 2 lines each the definitions of addition, multiplication, and exponentiation. So you've all seen that you can do lots of things just with recursive definitions of natural numbers on the one hand and lists on the other. Now, I bet if you think for a minute, you can come up with other kinds of data besides lists and natural numbers. Lists and natural numbers are very useful, but there are other things that you might want as well. So now what we're going to do today is learn how anything can be defined recursively in the same way that we defined natural numbers or lists. And the name for that is the algebraic data type. And you all get to be very proud of algebraic data types, because the concept of algebraic data type was developed by Rod Burstall, Don Sinella, and Dave McQueen in a tech report on a programming language called HOPE, which was released from the University of Edinburgh, of course. So Rod Burstall is now a retired member of staff. Don Sinella is a professor on the staff here still, and Dave McQueen is a professor at the University of Chicago. And Rod Burstall, for this work, won the SigPlan Programming Language Achievement Award 2 years ago. So this is the award given to the person who's done the most, well, sorry, not the person who's done the most, but each year given to somebody who's made a very substantial contribution to programming languages. And for the past 2 years, in fact, it's gone to people on the faculty here. Rod Burstall, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, 2 years ago, the last but one award went to Rod Burstall, and the current award went to Gordon Plotkin, who's also a professor on the faculty here. And I'm the chair of SigPlan, but that has nothing to do, honest, with the fact that 2 awards went here. In fact, when somebody proposed Gordon Plotkin, I want to say, no, don't do that, it'll be so embarrassing, because I'm the chair, but I didn't say that, and he got it, and he deserves it. So, algebraic data types are, in fact, an invention of the University of Edinburgh. So Here are just a few examples. What is it? 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 10 examples. So two of these, right, you're familiar with. A list of A is either nil, the empty list, or a cons with a head, which is A, and a tail, which is list of A. So this doesn't tell you that these things are called head and tail, but all the information you need is there. A natural number is either 0 or the successor of a natural number. And then here are lots of other examples. So in each of these, you give the name of the type and an equal sign, and then a bunch of alternatives separated by vertical bars. Okay, so the simplest possible example is a Boolean is either false or true. Another simple example, a season is either winter, spring, summer, or fall. Okay. These are both particularly simple because there's no type argument to the data type we're defining, like there is for list of A. Right? This is just a Boolean. It's always the same. It has no type parameters, whereas a list might be a list of integers or a list of characters or a list of integers and so on. And then the other thing is that here the constructors is each just a constructor name, just like nil or zero, but with no arguments, whereas cons has two arguments. So the first thing we can do is add arguments, right? So a shape is either a circle, which has a float, which will be its radius, or a rectangle, which has two floats, which will be its height and its width. Okay. And then expression is sort of nice. So this now we're getting self-descriptive. Here's a programming language feature. Here's a data type in our programming language that describes a small programming language. So an expression is either a literal integer, or the sum of two expressions, or the result of multiplying two expressions. Lists generalize to trees. So a tree is either empty, a tree of type A is either empty, or a leaf of A, or a branch of two trees. That's one way of doing trees. There are several others. Maybe is a famous one in Haskell. A maybe of A is either nothing or just an A. So what this does is it takes a data type and it makes a new data type, which is just like the old one. So we get all the values of the old one by sticking just on them, and then one more value, which is nothing. And this is very useful. Maybe is very useful for functions that may or may not return an answer. So for instance, division, strictly speaking, shouldn't return a floating point number. It should return a maybe of a floating point number, right? And which case would you return nothing? If you were dividing by zero, because the answer is not a number. Okay. We have pairs in Haskell, right? You just write them as things between parentheses, but you could define them as an algebraic data type. The data type of pair of A and B, so now we've got two types, is the constructor, which we'll also call pair, with two fields, one of type A and one of type B. So, and you can do triples and quadruples and so on in the same way. So the tuples that we have in Haskell just fall out as a special case of algebraic data type, just as Booleans fall out as a special case of algebraic data type. And then the last one that we've got here is the sum type. A sum of A and B is either a left of A or a right of B. Okay? Sorry? What does that mean? Just what it says. The sum type, let's see, what would an example be? A sum of an integer or a character would either be left of an integer or right of a character. So this is a type that contains all integers and all characters, labeled with either left if it's an integer or right if it's a character. So before people ask sort of things like, well, I can do a list of integers, I can do a list of characters, how can I do a list of things that are integers or characters? Well, you do a list of sum of int and char if you want to do that. Okay. Would you like to see some examples of using these things?
Yeah. Right.
So let's start with Booleans. Right? You've seen all this before, right? So now we just say, we'll define Booleans. A Boolean is false or true. And then not, right, is defined as not of false is true, not of true is false. And is defined as false and Q is always false. True and Q is always Q. Why does this work out? Well, false and anything should be false, right? True and false will be false. True and true will be true, the way we want it to be. Similarly for or. I don't need to go through or in detail, do I? And then one thing that's always quite useful for pretty much anything you can do is you want to define equality on it, and you want to define how to print the thing, how to convert it to a string. So equality for Booleans, right, you just work it out. False is equal to false, that's true. False equal to true, is false equal to true? No, so it's false. Is true equal to false? Come on, wake up. No, so it's false. Is true equal to true? Yes, so it's true. So is that definition clear to everybody? Any questions about that? Right. Don't forget, if you have a question, there are doubtless five other people, so do ask it. Okay? And similarly, to show a Boolean, well, this is really easy. Show of false is false, show of true is true. But look, right, false, here I wrote quotes around it. So this is a Boolean, but this is a list of characters. This is a string. So I've converted false to the string, F-A-L-S-E, and true to the string, T-R-U-E. Bored yet? Okay, let's go on. Seasons, very similar. So a season could be winter, spring, summer, or fall. And then we could define a function next. Next of winter is spring. Next of spring is summer. Next of summer is fall. Next of fall is winter. We could define equality for seasons. Right? Now, there are four possibilities. So if I wrote them all out, I'd have to write out 16 things, right? Each season, winter, winter, true. Each season, winter, spring, false, and so on. So here's a slightly more compact way of writing it. Winter is equal to winter. Spring is equal to spring. Summer is equal to summer. Fall is equal to fall. And if none of these four equations apply, this last one will apply. And if none of these four apply, x and y will be different, so we return false. Thus, the order of the equations is very important here. It's very important that this last one come last.
Can't we write x is in xx, and that's true, and if it's x?
It would be even more compact, right? X is in xx is true, x is in xy is false. But Haskell has a rule that when you're writing an equation like this, all the variables have to be different. If you want them to be the same, you would use a guard. So we could say x is an xx, a vertical bar, where x is equal to x. Oh, except we're defining equality. So that wouldn't work. Why wouldn't it work? We're allowed to use recursion, right? But in this case, the thing to determine if x is equal to, if winter is equal to winter, the way we'd answer that is asking, well, is winter equal to winter? And the way we'd find out is asking, well, is winter equal to winter? And we'd get into an infinite regress. And then to show a season, of course, we'd just convert it to a string again. And we could do things like convert integers, seasons to integers, and integers to seasons. Is that all clear? And then, of course, if we've got these two functions, that gives us, right, we define next this way, but if we had these two functions, toInt and fromInt, then we could just define next by saying convert x to an integer, add 1 to it, take it mod 4, right? Because if it was fall, 3 plus 1 is 4, and if we tried to convert 4 to a season, there isn't one, so we'll take it mod 4 and then convert it back from an int. Is it clear to everybody how next works there? Right? This is very similar to what you did when doing cyclic encoding of letters. And then that gives us a much easier way of defining eek season. Right? We could define eek season on seasons using equality on integers. Convert both seasons to integers and see if they're equal. This is so once we've got to and from it, some of these things become easier. Any questions so far? Am I going too slow? Yes.
You always define the equality rule as EQ and the name of the type with a capital letter. Is that compulsory or is it just your convention?
Oh, good question, right. Do you have to define equality this way? Right. The convention I'm following, as you pointed out, is to use EQ followed by the name of the type. But that's just a convention. You can call the function Fred if you want to.
But wouldn't it make more sense to actually define the equal operator instead of just...
Wouldn't it make more sense to actually define the equal operator? Yes, and we're going to learn how to do that next week. That's something called type classes. So for just now, we're using ordinary functions. And then we'll learn how to define our own instances of equals and so on next week. Good questions, thank you. Now I know at least one person's awake. Any other good questions? Okay, so let's look at shape. So notice that Haskell, as well as algebraic types, it lets you define abbreviation. So I can say radius is the really means float, and width really means float, and so on. So these things, unlike data, data makes a new type, completely different from any type that's been before. This does not make a new type. It just makes a new name for an existing type. Okay? So imagine Katerina here. Sorry to pick on you. Right, I could instead call you Bill, okay, and that'd be a new name, but would still refer to Katerina, which is very different, right? Just calling something that already exists by a new name is very different than making a new thing, right? If I was what's the name of it? Pygmalion, right? In Pygmalion, you create a whole new woman out of whole cloth, right? The in the myth. But that's very different than just giving a new name to an existing woman. So these just give new names to existing types, whereas this makes a completely new type, which is very different. So the shape type is either a circle with a radius, as a circle with a floating point number, or a rectangle with the width and the height, as two floating point numbers. And then we can define functions like area. So the area of a circle with radius r is, of course, pi times r squared, where pi is elsewhere defined to be 3.142 whatever, up to the precision of the computer. And the area of rectangle with width w and height h is just w times h. Okay, then we can do equality. So how would we do that? So a circle with radius r is equal to a circle with radius r prime if the radiuses are the same. And similarly, a rectangle with width w and h and a rectangle with width w prime and h prime are the same if the widths are the same and the heights are the same. And otherwise, they're not equal. So is the way eek shape is defined clear to everybody? You didn't nod. You in the back with your hands on your face. Is it clear to you? Next time you'll nod. Okay, and then to show a shape, we have to give the name of the constructor and show all the parts. So I'm going to assume a function show f, which knows how to print out a floating point, convert a floating point number to a string. And then we would do circle and a space, and then the representation of r. And similarly for a rectangle, we'd print rect and a space, and then we'd convert the width to a string, and another space, and convert the height to a string. And notice that I had to be careful, right, in defining show f, I was a bit careful to get it correct in that if it's positive, I just convert it to a string, but if it's negative, I also put parentheses around it. Can anybody see why I did that? Right, because otherwise it would be, if it was a circle with radius minus 3, you probably don't run into too many of those. But if it was a circle with radius minus 3, it would print circle space dash 3, which means circle minus 3, not circle of minus 3. So that's the reason for the parentheses. Right, and then, right, lists are very straightforward, right? This is exactly the definition of append you've seen before, but using now the nil and cons that you'd use in an actual data construction. So in some sense, right, what I've written for the data type declaration here is not legal Haskell, okay? But this is in essence what we do. When we write bracket something, close bracket as a type, it means this list of that thingy. When I write empty list, it means nil. And when I write colon, it means the cons constructor. So this is just so that you can see that the built-in notations for Haskell really just correspond to an algebraic data type. And there's one important thing that I probably should have written there but did not. So I'll just write it down. I'll write down if I can find a piece of chalk. Here we go. Right, which is, I told you that a list has two fields if it's constructed, the head and the tail. How would I define that? It's hard to read, isn't it? Let's see if I can find a better erased bit of board. Yeah. This is hard work. This is no more erased. Yeah, I could use the blackboards on either side, and I guess I will, since this one is such a mess. But of course, it won't come out on the video. Left, right. Oh, the green button. Thank you. Yeah, it's a lot easier than doing it by hand. These are all messed up. This is bad. Oh, there's an eraser here. I'm going to see if erasing it makes it any better, but I bet it doesn't. No. Maybe a little. All right, we'll try it. Old tech. That's readable. Head takes a list of A to an A. And I'll define head of cons of x and x's is what? X. So this is the complete definition of head. So if you want to say, look, the head of a list that's constructed is the first component, you would just write this. And of course, tail is very similar, right? The tail of cons of x and x's is x's. So that's all you need to write. If you want to be very explicit, you could write, but wait a minute, this doesn't tell you what the head of nil is. Right? And the answer is if you try to work out the head of nil, the computer will give you an error. If you want to be explicit about that, There's a particular function predefined in Haskell called undefined. So you could say the head of nil is undefined, but you don't need to do that. Okay, so that's how I would define head of a list. Is that clear enough? Oh, sorry. I mixed notations. I shouldn't do that. All right, the head of a list of A will be of type A. Oh, very good question. Is undefined equal to undefined? Right. Undefined is a special term that behaves very much like 1 divided by 0. If you try to compute the value of 1 undefined, the computer says, you can't do that. So if you try to work out if undefined is equal to undefined, right, what does the stupid computer do? Well, first it tries to work out the value of the first argument to equals, which is undefined. What is the value of undefined? You can't do that. So if you try to say is undefined equal to undefined, it will say you can't do that. In fact, undefined means you can't do that. So undefined equals to undefined returns the value undefined. There's actually a whole mathematical theory of all this, which is very useful to getting insight, where undefined is a particular value in the theory, which is pronounced bottom.
If we use undefined as part of another function, that will return undefined as well?
Usually yes. But remember that Haskell is lazy. Right, so Haskell only works things out if it needs to. And one aspect of these data constructors is it only works out the arguments if it needs to know what they are. So what is the head of cons of 1 and undefined? You might think, oh, it's undefined. But it's not, because it doesn't need to know what undefined is. So the head of cons of 1 and undefined is 1. So it's only undefined if it can't work out what's going on. Okay. Expression trees. Right? So I said expression is either a literal, which is an integer, or an add of two expressions, or a multiply of two expressions. So now the most interesting thing, right? We talked about show inequality before. Have I got eek? Let's see, where is eek? Oh, I didn't define eek. Okay, I'll leave that as an exercise for the reader. But show, right, to show the literal n, just show n. To show e added to f, now what I'm going to do this time is I'm going to convert e to a string, put a plus there, and convert f to a string. And similarly for mul, but with the times in between. And then I'll put parentheses around the outside. So par of a string just is an open parenthesis, the string, and a closed parenthesis. And I think we've got some examples. Right. So if E0 is lit 2 of add and lit 3 of mul and lit 3, and E1 is lit 2 of add, lit 3, the whole thing with mul of lit 3, right? So here I'm putting these things in back quotes and writing them in the middle, right? Which is just like not putting them in back quotes and writing them at the front. So now if we show E0, right, we get 2 plus 3 times 3. And if we show E1, we get 2 plus 3 times 3 with the parentheses the other way. Is that clear enough to everybody? Okay. And then the other thing we can do is, right, so when I wrote x, add x pair with the add in back quotes, that's of course the same as just saying add exp exp. They both mean exactly the same thing. But because plus and multiply are at MO are infix operators. It's much easier to write these infix. So now we can define eval, right, which takes an expression to an integer. And we say, well, to eval lit n, that's just n. And to eval e add f, we just evaluate e and evaluate f and add them together. And for multiply, it's the same thing, but we multiply them together. And so then if we apply eval x to e0, we get 2 plus 3 times 3, which is 11. And if we eval x to e1, we get 2 plus 3, right? So we recursively call eval on 2 plus 3. That gives us 5. Eval of this 3 is 3. 5 times 3 is 15. Now, is that clear, or does somebody want to see the stupid computer at work actually evaluating one of these things? We'll take a vote. Who wants to see the stupid computer do that? Nobody. Who wants to not see it? Lots of people. Okay, fine. I feel confident skipping it then. Good. So you all understand how that works. Question?
Is add and null predefined?
This add and this null?
Yeah.
No, I'm defining them right here. So you remember? Right, there were all these things. Each thing was of the form name equals constructor argument. Constructor argument argument. So it's a constructor followed by zero or more arguments. So here, for x, constructor argument, constructor two arguments, constructor two arguments. And then instead of writing add exp exp, as I've done here, I can write exp, add in back quotes exp, and it means the same thing. Is that clear enough to everybody? Right. It's really convenient being able to write things infix, which is why Haskell supports this. But maybe it's not so convenient having to remember that two different things mean the same thing. Oh, I see why I got in trouble. Right, here it is prefix. Ah. Here it is prefix, all done prefix, in the way we would normally. Sorry that I got confused there. Here's some examples. And then here are the same definitions done infix. And now when you write, right, why do we do this? Right, because this is a pain to read. Add of lit 2 and mul of lit 3 and lit 3. You can read it, but it's very difficult. Whereas lit 2 add lit 3 mul lit 3 is much easier to read. So that's the reason for supporting these two different notations. Furthermore, what's even better, right, is Haskell allows you to have as a name for a constructor not a word. So, have you noticed? Right. Every time I write a type name, it begins with a capital letter. Every time I write a constructor name, it begins with a capital letter. Okay. This is actually very important. Right. I've skipped over this, but let's just go back for a minute. Right. Notice when I wrote this, these two things are constructors. These are constructors. These are constructors. These are constructors. These are variables. Right? Winter only matches winter, nothing else. X is a variable. It matches anything. Right? So constructors and variables behave very differently. And this is why there's a rule that says any constructor name must begin with a capital. Any variable name must begin with a small letter. And this makes it easy to ensure that you don't confuse constructors with variables, which is important because, as I said, this just matches winter. This doesn't just match X. This matches anything at all. It's just a variable name. So they behave very differently. So that's not just a convention. That's built into the language. Constructors must begin with capitals. But we know that we can use things like plus as a function name, right? Which we write infix, which is very convenient. Can we do the same with constructors? Yes, but we need a symbol that begins with a capital. How are we going to do that? Well, what we did, it's a bit weird, is we picked one particular character, one particular symbol, and we said anything that begins with that symbol is like a capital letter. Okay? And the special symbol is? Does anybody know? Lambda. No, we use lambda for functions.
Dollar sign.
Dollar sign. That would be a good choice because it's not used for anything else. So you can actually work it out, right? What's the one thing that you've seen as an infix symbol that you can use in definitions?
Colon.
Right? We use colon for cons. Cons is, of course, a constructor. So at least here, it was something beginning with a colon that we used as a constructor. Right? So that's the rule. Anything that begins with a colon is a constructor. Nothing else is. So if we want to use symbols, we use colon plus. Colon plus would work, but I decided to call it colon plus colon because it looks a bit more symmetric. Right? And colon star colon. So now we can write out a definition of a data type that looks a lot like what we're acting with. So you can build a little programming language inside your programming language. And now when we write the examples, they're almost readable. Yes?
Is the colon plus colon a function?
No, it's a constructor, like cons. What's the difference between a function and a constructor? There's only one. Okay? And we've seen the difference, but I've not made a lot of it. Right? Constructors can be written in the left-hand side of equations. Right? Here we're matching against these constructors. Right? With colon in list definitions, you can write colons. Right? You can write colons in the middle of the left-hand side of the definition.
So plus plus is also a constructor?
Nope. The one thing at the top, like append, is a function. How can you tell that it's a function rather than a constructor? Well, among other things, it begins with a small letter, so it couldn't be a constructor.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the rule for the left-hand side of the function definition? It's the function name followed by zero or more patterns. What's the rule for a pattern? It's a constructor name followed by zero or more patterns, or it's a variable. Okay. So the things that can appear after the function name are variables, or here we have a constructor name followed by zero patterns, or here we have a constructor name followed by two patterns, each of which is itself a variable. Those are the only things that can appear on the left-hand side of a function definition. And then there's, you know, the special case if you write something infix, then that's the function function name. We did here, we're doing append infix. But so here's our function name, here's a constructor with two arguments, each of which is itself a pattern. That's a little bit tricky, but just is you define the function name, then you define constructors. I'll explain more about the details of how this works tomorrow, which I hope will make it a little bit clearer. So those are just some notational tricks that make life easier. Now, using these notational tricks, we can define our own new programming languages inside a programming language. And as an example, I will use propositions, which you've been learning about in the computation and logic part of the course. So I'll start on this today, but I'll continue it tomorrow. Okay? Right? This is the jump up and down part of the class. How do you know if you really understand something? You know that you really understand something if you can turn to the person next to you and explain it to them. How do you know that you really, really understand something if you can explain it to somebody who's not very bright? How do you know if you really, really, really understand something? Get a computer to do it. Right? What could be more moronic than a computer? Right? So the way that you know that you truly understand something is not if you can do it, not if you can explain it to somebody else, but if you can explain it well enough, that is, write a program that gets a computer to do it. Okay? So that's what we're going to do for the computation and logic part of this course, which I'm sure you've all mastered perfectly, right? So you know you understand it well if you can do the exercises for the course. You know you understand it better if you can explain to somebody else how to do the exercises. But you understand it really